Today, how the place we find ourselves is often where we lose everyone else.
Welcome to Coffee with Creamer, where you get to sit down with our host, Dr. Barry Creamer, for a conversation about faith, life, and culture. We'll look at old ideas through a new lens, turn those culture wars on their head, and paint a picture of the way things could be. If you like your thinking deep and your coffee hot, pull up a chair. You're in the right place.
Again, I'll remind you that we have a website, barrycreamer.com, where you may want to look at details about the episode, certain references, texts, things like that, a book that's referred to. Or we have some devotionals also that are out each week, which might encourage you to face your week and remember who you are, who we are. I'm always coming at this as a believer and hoping to create a more peaceable environment. In the process, though, of being very diligent and committed to going where we've been called to go. I'm going to warn you, today's episode is complex. It's a little long. And so I don't mean long in time. I mean, we're going to cover a lot of territory. And it's something really important for us to talk about, though. So I want to encourage you to hang in there with it. I, not too long ago, remember us having a run on gas stations. We weren't actually having a gas shortage. There was plenty of gas being distributed, but gas stations were all out of gas, and you couldn't find anywhere to buy gas most of the time. And so I told my friends, I remember telling some of them specifically, don't go fill your tank right now. I know you might need it, and you might be out at some point, but right now you're not out. So don't go do it, because the fact that all of us together are rushing to the stations to fill up our tanks is what's causing the problem. I mean, it's not contributing to the problem. It was causing the problem. So I was telling them, be different from everyone else. Don't be the problem. If that's the problem, don't be the problem, right? That's not super complicated. Now, the problem with that solution that I offered is that friends also needed and knew they would need gas, exactly like everyone else who was running to the gas station to get their gas. They were identifying themselves perfectly, completely, totally with the community in which they lived by their behavior, by the thing that they were choosing to do. And because each, and this is part of the problem, because each member of the entire community, because each member wanted to be considered more important than the others in the community, that is, I need to get gas before my neighbor. What could that possibly mean other than my need needs to take priority over the needs of others? That's what it means. Because of that, every single member was contributing to the problem that the whole community was experiencing and that every individual in the community knew was absurd. And we wouldn't stop it. It was driving me crazy. I know I have an advantage. I ride a bike to Criswell College, where I get to be the president, on a regular basis. And so I could get where I was going most of the time without having to worry about gas. But the truth is, I would have done exactly the same thing even if I drove my truck every single day. Yeah, I drive a gas-guzzling truck. It's not, judgment aside, we'll come back to that later. But because each member wanted to be treated above others, every member of the community suffered from that outage. Now, that's not the point for today. It's just an illustration of how complex the relationship between me as an individual and me as a member of the community, and then the community as a whole, can become. We are thinking of individual rights as the thing that establishes our community, and then we're living in a way that makes us not individuals, but just part of this corpus, part of this giant body that acts like it does, and nothing can be done about it. That all that does, all I'm trying to introduce with that is the reality that there are some very complex relationships there. C.S. Lewis identifies some of the complexities about it and in a way that's pertinent to us personally. And this is how, and this, again, this is just leading the way to understand what today's discussion is really about. And I said it was how we find ourselves, our identity, in the very place where we lose everyone else. This is what happens. So as subjects, as people who experience things ourselves, we often lose our own identity in the faith that we have. I'm not talking about just becoming a Christian, but I do mean the way we exercise our faith, and especially the way we become parts of communities. And it depends on the type of community whether this is the case or not. So people can lose themselves in the relationships that they have with other people. And losing our identity means being devoured by somebody who's more powerful than us. And this is for people who've read C.S. Lewis, you know what I'm referring to. In the Screwtape Letters, he deals with that. He talks about this as the guiding principle of hell, one of the letters that comes from the demon, you know, who's corresponding with other demons about how they're tempting someone. And if you've never read the Screwtape Letters, you need to read it. I mean, it's a classic. But this is one paragraph in that book. The whole philosophy of hell rests on recognition. Now, this is, remember, these are the words of a demon. C.S. Lewis is writing through the mouth of a demon the things that he thinks are true, though, about how Satan does things. And so he says the whole philosophy of hell rests on recognition of the axiom that one thing is not another thing. And you see, there's a lot of truth in this. So this is why C.S. Lewis has this demon saying it. And especially that one self is not another self. My good, this is the quote, my good is my good and your good is yours. What one gains, another loses. Even an inanimate object is what it is by excluding all the other objects from the space it occupies. If it expands, it does so by thrusting other objects aside or by absorbing them. A self does the same with, and this is still quoting from C.S. Lewis, who's quoting a demon, with beasts, the absorption takes the form of eating. For us, it means the sucking of will and freedom out of a weaker self into a stronger. That is, to be means to be in competition. So, look, this statement, which is an insightful statement, this is not shallow thinking, shallow philosophy or theology, either one, is a really important concept. I mean, you know, the devil is a roaring lion, walks about seeking whom he may devour. I mean, this language is something that makes sense to us in Scripture, that passage that Peter gives us, you know, in his first epistle. So it does make sense theologically, and we've all seen it happen, even with individuals relating to other individuals. Individuals can consume other individuals. People we know and love have been devoured by the people they've given themselves to. But this is the thing. Once that happens, even with just two individuals, one of them empowered and consuming the other one, their personality simply disappears into the more powerful one. Once that happens, you have a community or a family or a group or whatever you want to call it, even if it's just two people, and neither individual, not the stronger one, not the weaker one, is any more defined solely as that individual. Now they're bound to, they're identified with that pair, group, community, whatever, the mob, you know, whatever you want to identify that social group with. Individuals can devour one another. We all know this. And here's the part that makes it so tricky for us. Fulfilling our identity means fulfilling the purpose of giving ourselves away for the sake of others. This is what Christ calls us to do. When we say we want to follow him, he says, oh, at first you have to die to yourself. Well, he doesn't mean by that yourself needs to be devoured by me. That's not what he does. Christ does the opposite, as we'll talk about in a moment. But fulfilling our identity is a call to love others in the way Christ loved us. So we do have to give ourselves away. How does that happen? Well, C.S. Lewis illustrates it by having, you know, he gives the opposite of what Satan does, devouring those who either give themselves to him or don't even know what's happening to them. Satan devours those who are under his power. But Christ takes those who have less power than him And he offers to them his body, his spilled blood. He gives them in the communion himself. This is the point that C.S. Lewis is making, that we do the opposite. When we're called to follow Christ, we're called to do the opposite of what the powerful in the world do or what Satan does. We're called to give ourselves away to those who are weaker than us, those who would not have the power to devour us, but we give it to them. We say, I want to pour out my life for you. I want to be the one who serves you. And as this is just introducing the topic. So I'm just trying to give you a context for understanding what we're going to be talking about in a minute. Often in the West, in the modern world, you know, since the Enlightenment, since the 18th, 17th and 18th centuries, we think of individualism as a really important part of our own identity, and that's good. Nothing wrong with that. But we think of it so distinctly that we integrate this point of our identity, of not being consumed by others, into a contest of freedom or community obligations. And you can see this. This is not the topic for today. Do not panic. I'm not going this direction. But we can see that in all the debates and arguments about whether mask mandates make sense or not, or whether people ought to get vaccinated or whatever. I'm not even wading into those waters today, just making the point that that's at the point of conflict between individual liberties and belonging to a community where you have to drive on a single side of the road because the community says so, not because you feel like it in a given moment. So this is on the subjective side, the reality that we realize that we can lose ourselves when we give ourselves to a more powerful community or a more powerful person, and it's a risk. Or in our relationship with others who are not as powerful as we are, we can give ourselves away. This is how C.S. Lewis describes the topic in the domain of what I want to talk about today. But what I want to talk about today is how first our identity is inherently, meaning inescapably, intrinsically, it's built into it from the beginning, natively, whatever word you want to use for it, it is inherently in our community. We find our identity in relationship with others. There's no way to get around that, and yet we are not very aware of this, especially as Western believers. And especially, I'll go beyond that, especially as American Christians. This is a difficult concept for us, partially because we just don't think about it very much, and partially because it's not always comfortable. So we need to talk in just a second about how our identity is inherently wrapped up in our community. So now the question is, how our identity is inherently wrapped up in our community. Some of us do not want to believe that, and yet it is the way God describes us. And honestly, sociologically, psychologically, it's fairly obvious that's the reality of what we have to deal with. Human nature is that we include in our understanding of ourselves both a public and a private nature. And I don't mean by that hidden and revealed. I don't mean by that wicked and sinister and then transparent. I don't mean that. I mean public, as in we understand ourselves as part of a society, and then private. We understand ourselves as being distinct from the other members of that society. We are both individual and communal. It's built in. So if I say the words, who are you? And you give me a name, that doesn't mean anything to me. I have to know what is in the person who is represented by that name. And then any characteristic you can give me that would identify you, you know, so anything that you could give is going to put you in a group or a community or a category, either actively, like I'm a card-carrying communist, which I'm not, in case you're worried, or passively, like he's that and didn't even know it. And we used to make jokes about that with people. We would we would say, they came to a youth event, and they got saved and didn't even know it. That idea that you become part of a community, sometimes you do become a part of a community and don't even realize you're part of it. It can be by accident, not intentionally. It's just happenstance. It's just the way it happens to be. You're in this group of people who are in an airplane who happens to be in this situation that nobody wanted to be in. Or by nature, you were genetically predisposed to this. I am a blonde, or I am a brunette, or whatever it is you would identify yourself with. Or a choice. I've chosen to vote this way. I identify with this party of politics or whatever group it is that you identify with by choice. It can be by participation. I'm doing stuff with them, or simply identification. Others see me as a part of that group so that I am this kind of person, an American or a Christian or a POC or a professional or an addict or single or a parent or a Democrat or a farmer or a survivalist or a hipster or clergy or a princess. Whatever it is that you identify yourself with in any of those things where you're saying, who are you? Well, I am. Those are your community identification. They are the group or category or community or whatever with which you have to identify yourself. And these, the things that help you, that help us identify you, but help you identify yourself by lumping you together with a bunch of other people, this is the way they help us. They lump you together with a bunch of other people who are not you. That's the point of being part of a community or a group. Now we can identify who you are, but we're doing it by lumping you together with people who are not you. So there's a strength to it and a weakness to it. Doesn't matter. Doesn't matter that we like it or don't like it. It's just a reality of humanity. Human beings are not solitary individuals. Human beings are part of a community, part of a society. We live together. It's how we function. You could not have people if people did not come together. It's not possible for us to continue to exist that way. We're not earthworms, if you get what I'm saying. Theologically, this is true. And this should not trouble us at all. Theologically, whether you word it as original sin, label it as original sin, or whatever you want to call it, Adam's curse, we are identified together with humanity in this fallen state. You are a human being, and therefore you are in this, you experience the human condition. Even for people who are not theological, simply the words, the human condition, identify this tension, this irony that exists between what we want to be able to do, what we know should be true about us, and the reality of what we know is lacking in us. For as, this is the way Paul says it in Romans, as by one man's disobedience, the many were made sinners. That's not by every man's disobedience, many were made sinners. It's by one man's disobedience, many were made sinners. So by one man's obedience, the many will be made righteous. And again, it doesn't matter whether you take the theological terms of the New Testament or put it in other categories. We are lumped together with other people. And you see that carrying forward in the narrative of the Old Testament, by the way. And Adam and Eve, when they both sinned together, that wasn't an accident. Or Abel and Cain who kills Abel, obviously, or Lamech, two or three, four generations removed from Abel, from Seth, who is then killing people and saying, oh, I'll be avenged of death, and Noah the same way, as soon as he emerges, is fallen again, and so on. You get the idea. We're a part of that. We can't pretend we're not a part of a world that experiences the tension between what we ought to be and what we really are, which is much less than we know we ought to be. Culturally, it's the same thing. I've used this expression many times, we paint our lives on the canvas of a culture in which we live. Nobody's painting in thin air. Nobody's creating their individual life in thin air. Oh, it's just me. I don't know anybody else. This is all about me. It's not possible. You're painting on a canvas, and that canvas is the community, the group, the culture within which you are existing. The fact that you're painting your life in a canvas of, if you're in the United States, you're painting your life on a canvas of prosperity. You are painting your life in a canvas where freedom of speech, freedom of religion, are assumptions that we make. I'm not saying they're never challenged, but they are assumptions that we make. You're also painting your life on a canvas where abortion has been standard practice for 50 years. And regardless of what we do with the laws, we'll be expected by half the population to be the best solution when they find themselves in an unplanned pregnancy. Abortion is part of the canvas on which we paint our lives. And the same is true about racism. It's part of the canvas. I'm not saying you personally have to be a racist for this to be the case. You're painting, but you're painting on a canvas where that exists. And as hard as it is for us to recognize it, our group identity, our public identity, is an essential part of who we are. Economically, we are inextricably tied into every part of our economy. There is no way that I can invest money in this economy, that I can buy a candy bar without being a part of everything else that happens in the economy. And that's participating with people in the economy who do payday loans, which is a horribly vicious practice. And I'm not saying every person who owns a payday loan company is a wicked person, but it is an abuse of people. It's like loan sharking, but legal kind of thing. Every kind of numbers rackets, even if they're run by the government, and the abortion industry I was talking about a moment ago, or slavery's legacy. It's all part of this economy that has built up that I have to live in. If I eat in this culture, I am participating in the full economy of the culture. The city takes out bonds, you drive on the streets, and the money comes from every possible source, including the places you pass and think, oh man, I would never support that. But we all do. There's no way we can get out of the reality of our identification within the community where we exist. The parts that we like and the parts we don't like, they're a part of our identity. So what happens is God has this view of us as public or communal beings that leads to judgment. There's no escaping it. So I've said this many times from Daniel 9, Daniel's prayer, where Daniel himself is a righteous man. Daniel is a righteous man. He's identified as such. He is praying for forgiveness for us. He says, we have sinned. We have violated. We need your forgiveness and your mercy and so on. And he knows the difference. In Matthew 25, the judgment that comes at the end of that chapter of the sheep and the goats is not a judgment of individuals. It's a judgment of peoples, a judgment of nations who have either received those who were sent to them as messengers of God or rejected them one way or the other. Now, I know you're going to have to read the story and make sense of it, but I'm not going to go through the whole thing right now. But that's what that chapter is about. If we receive those messengers, we'll talk more about it toward the end. Our view, now that's God's, God, of course, God can do this because he's omnipotent, he's omniscient, he's able to see everything. And so it makes sense for God to be able to judge an entire nation. And by the way, when he judges nations, even when he says he judges the whole nation, like Israel, often he leaves a remnant. He has somebody that he spares. So I'm not saying he ignores individuals. I am saying that he looks at communities and judges them as communities. Our view of others as public or communal beings follows that same pattern, but we're not omniscient. So this becomes a problem, because when we distrust strangers, when we distrust people who don't speak our language, when we distrust people who have a certain kind of appearance, who look threatening, whatever it is, when we distrust people, when we first evaluate them based on something about them that's different from us, then we put ourselves in a really risky position of acting like we're capable of doing what only God is actually capable of doing. Hence, all of these commandments not to judge. First, to look at ourselves and judge ourselves. And then, in the only legitimate practice of judgment that a believer would have, we do it for the benefit of the person we're looking at and saying, hey, something's wrong. Let me help pull that mote out of your eye, using the King James language. But first, we pull the beam out of our own eye, with which, by the way, we were taking a whack at the whole community that they were in before. When the crowds are rejecting Saul or Paul in Jerusalem, it's because they're rejecting the Gentiles. Read the story as they're rejecting Paul. That's what it's all. They listen to him quietly until he says, "And God sent me to bring the Gentiles in." And then they go crazy and want to kill him, and they have to carry him away to the prison, you know. The church's distrust of Gentiles early on in the church in the book of Acts is that same thing, looking at a community that's different from us and putting them at arm's length at best, putting them at the end of rope's judgment at its worst. This is not what we ought to do, but it is what we do. You know, Aristotle makes this point that the only person, so to get back to this, when we're judging people on the basis of their identity within a community, then that's a problem. We all recognize this. It's a prejudice. It's discriminatory. Whatever language, whatever label we want to put on it, we recognize that it's wrong, but it is what we do. It's the way we identify individuals in bulk, in mass, or from a distance, or quickly, or at first glance, or when people say it casually and comfortably. I'm really good at first impressions. That's what we're doing. We're saying, hey, all people who act the way you just acted are people who I can say this about, and passing judgment on them as part of a community. And Aristotle makes this point. There's no way for us to get out of being part of a community. The only person who's not dependent on a community for their identity, this is based on Aristotle, is a beast or a god. And we're not beasts, and we're not God. So we find our identity in that community. What we need to recognize is that that judgment is reserved to God. Categorizing, stereotyping, generalizing are the evidence that we have failed to leave that judgment to God. More in a moment. So when we're practicing judgment and do it by categorizing or stereotyping or generalizing, which we would like to think we don't do, but it's just sort of built into us as human beings, partially because that's where we find our identity. So that's how we look at others' identity also, especially at first. Because until you actually get to know the individual, what else are you going to do? You have to judge them based on how they compare with everybody else who looks kind of like that person looked to you. So this is the way we try to avoid saying that what we have done is offensive. We assuage our offenses. We dismiss our sins against individuals with the phrase, "It's not personal." Rejection is not. Condemnation is not. But redemption is. Do you get what I'm saying? Rejection doesn't have to be personal. Condemnation doesn't have to be personal. But redemption has to be personal. This James Baldwin, whom I would not advocate in terms of having an ideal ideology, but brilliant writer, brilliant creative mind, and a really good critic of some of the things that were wrong with us back in the civil rights era, and somebody who ought to be heard just because of that, not necessarily because of his solutions, but his critiques are legitimate. His statement was this: the people are one mystery, a person is another. The challenge, you get the idea, is for us to stop simply looking at people who are a threat to us and seeing them as this dark threat, and look at individuals, look at the person, relate to the person, which is still a mystery. It's still a real challenge to relate to an individual. But seeing others not just as part of the society, not just as part of a community or a category or a group, but seeing others as individuals, that's what allows us to begin to regard them as of equal value with us as individuals. And it changes the way we judge them, or that we deem them worthy of the effort to do more than condemn them. You can see this in the illustration I was giving about the run on the gas stations. The only way you could say to yourself, there's no way I could love a person and look at them and say, you are just as valuable as I am, and I'm going to get the gas, not you. There's no way you would do that. You would be saying, hey, I'm going to go get gas, but I'm going to share it with you. If you cared about the other individual, the only way that you could prioritize getting your gas over everybody else's gas is if everybody else was just this lump of a category instead of individuals with which you wanted to deal. And so our dealing with people is a mess because we judge them within their category, within their groups, instead of as individuals. And as believers, our goal has to become redemption. It can't be condemnation. The fruit of righteousness is sown in peace of those who make peace. Our goal is reconciliation. So in redemption, how we see others as individuals beyond their community group is the way that we find them as redeemable individuals. This is the lesson that Jesus gives us in the New Testament. A few examples in just a second. Examples are not cherry-picked from the Gospels so that I can make this point. These are the inescapable point made over and over in all four Gospels. And you'll recognize that, which is why I'm just presenting a variety, a random variety of the stories where this is the point that's made, that Jesus, while he is dealing with crowds, steps into the crowd so that he can get to the individual who he then sees in all of their weakness and all of their need and offers redemption. And in these cases, provides redemption or healing of some kind. And I mean, the first and obvious example is when he has given his Sermon on the Mount and then steps back after the statement that everyone who asks receives. Everyone who knocks, to them the door is open. Everyone who seeks finds. After he says all of that, a leper comes to him and receives. A leper wants cleansing and receives it. The Gentile centurion, the outsider, this stranger ought to be ignored. The Gentile centurion comes to Jesus and says, hey, my servant needs to be healed. And his servant is healed. This sick woman is in need of healing. And Jesus touches her, violating this commandment of the Old Testament not to touch those who are unclean. And she is healed. He does that with the leper also. In each case, Jesus is ministering to the individual, and the author, in this case Matthew, the author is always wanting us to see that he pays attention to the individual. The example from Luke may be the most obvious one, and actually, there are just so many obvious ones. This is just one that stands out. In Luke 8, you remember the story of the woman with the issue of blood. And so this is Jesus being pressed on by the crowd when it's happening. Jesus is being pressed on by the crowd, but this one individual woman who has an issue of blood for a dozen years or so, can't find any healing with physicians, it says, she came behind him and touched the fringe of his garment. She just touches the fringe of his tallit, his prayer shawl. And immediately, she's healed. And Jesus responds, he's being pressed by the crowd. But this one woman touched him for the purpose of being healed. And he says, who is it that touched me? As one person's contact mattered, the crowd was not being healed because they touched him. The one woman who reached out and touched the hem of his prayer garment is the one who is healed. Who touched me? And Peter's response to that emphasizes it even more. The crowds are surrounding you, Peter says, and they're pressing in on you. Why are you asking who touched you? Everyone's touching you. What are you talking about? And Jesus says, no. I perceived that virtue, strength, power went out from me. He gave something up, and this is the sacrifice of the Messiah. We'll talk about that another day. But when the woman saw that she couldn't be hidden, she thought, I am hiding in a crowd. I'm safe. I can reach out and touch, and nobody will even know I did it. But Jesus knew because he cared about the individual. And he ends up saying to her, daughter, your faith has made you whole. Go in peace. He's saying it to the individual. Jesus wades into crowds so that he can see the individual who is weak and in need and meet their need. Same thing happens in John 5 at the Pool of Bethesda. You all know the story. Guy laying next to a pool on the myth that if you, somebody will just lower me into the water, I'll be healed. And Jesus comes to him and says, why are you sitting here? That he had been there for years. He had been paralyzed for years. And when Jesus saw him lying there, knew that he had already been there a long time, he said to him, "Do you want to be healed?" And the man said, "I don't have anyone. I am alone. I have no one." And in his complete isolation, Jesus says to him, "Get up, take your bed, walk." And at once the man is healed. Jesus meets the need of that individual. When he sees individuals, he cares for them. The same thing happening on the way to Jerusalem in the story that's told in two different gospels. But in Matthew, it's told about two men outside of Jericho as Jesus goes on the way to Jerusalem being surrounded by a great crowd. And there are two men sitting by the road who cry out, "Lord, have mercy on us, son of David." And the crowd rebukes them. You don't get any privilege. You don't get a special treatment here. And they say, "Lord, have mercy on us." And Jesus stops and calls them and says, "What do you want me to do for you?" And they said, "Well, that our eyes would be opened." And in pity, he touched their eyes. And immediately, they recovered their sight and they followed him. The lessons are obvious that this is just the case that God brings judgment on peoples, but he brings redemption also. And as he brings redemption in the person of Christ, the person that I'm following, Jesus, he wades into those crowds so that he can bring redemption to the individuals. I want to put some sense into this and to what the point is for us in just a second. Of course, there are ways we are supposed to see peoples and nations differently and redeemed. That is, Jonah with the Assyrians in Nineveh. He's not picking out individuals and redeeming them. I get that. But that point is also made when God breaks down the nation. And this is at the end of the book of Jonah. Just go read it and you'll see how he does it. He makes the point to Jonah by saying, "But there are children there." And he even refers to the cattle because he's covering all of creation, how God is sovereign over all of it. That's the point, part of the point in Jonah. But the point is that God says to Jonah, who wants that nation to be judged. That's why he didn't want to go there. It's why he's bitter at the end when they're not judged. Everything about Jonah is looking at the people group and saying, "I despise them, I reject them." And he is supposed to see that they ought to be redeemed and that God wants to redeem them. But the way God breaks through to Jonah and makes that point, and yeah, I believe he breaks through to Jonah because Jonah writes the book, right? So the point is given to us. The way he gets through to Jonah is by saying, "But there are children there. There are people there that I care about. Can you not see past their identification as Assyrians to their identification as people I created, persons I created?" And he gives numbers to it. Look at these individuals who ought to be considered. And the same thing, again, there are ways that we're supposed to think of peoples or nations as being redeemed. The sheep in the sheep and the goats parable that we were talking about in Matthew 25, the sheep are redeemed. But in that story, in that whole chapter in Matthew 25, we're supposed to learn that they're redeemed because they saw the messengers of God, the strangers who were coming to them with this crazy message from God about redemption, they saw the messengers of God, his children, who bring that message of good news about redemption, not as dangerous strangers lumped in with all those strange people we don't know, but as welcomed guests. That's why they're received. "You gave me food. You gave me water when I came to you." Jesus is not just talking about feeding the poor. He's talking about taking care of the messengers he is sending around the world with the gospel to bring redemption. When you welcomed in my messengers as guests into your home, they brought the message of salvation. And lo and behold, your nation is redeemed because of it. It's what happens in Philippi, by the way. If you want to go read a story about it in the gospel, in the book of Acts, you would read about it in Philippi, when instead of being rejected outright by all the people of Philippi, Lydia, this one woman outside of town, welcomes them into her home. And ultimately, the jailer welcomes them into his home. And suddenly, there's a church, and the city is saved from the judgment of Sodom and Gomorrah that was about to come on it, the earthquake that opened the jail. Go read the story, and you'll see what I'm talking about. Until this is the point, and I'll leave it at this for this time. But there's so much we need to gain in our hearts, our souls as believers, so that we can begin to make our lives more obedient to what God has called us to do, so that we can model for our community how it can be better. There's so much that has to happen. This is just a first step in that direction. So until we arrive at the shore where we see other peoples and other nations as the heirs of God's kingdom and his love, then until that day arrives, which I'm not saying is coming anytime soon, our commission is to see individuals that way, to remember they have a backstory and gifts and wounds and value, that they have a soul just like ours, yet distinct enough that God deems them personally worthy of creating, worthy of redemption, worthy of our personal attention. Let's treat them not as our competition, not as our enemy, not even just like a different creation of God, but like the person God created for us to see and hear and serve.
Thanks for joining us for Coffee with Creamer. Your cup of coffee may be finished, but we are not. Come back next week for a refill as we sit down to examine a new set of ideas and cultural issues. Don't miss an episode. Subscribe wherever you get your podcasts or visit our website at barrycreamer.com. Until next time, keep your mug hot and your mind sharp.